welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 432 for Wednesday, the 16th of January, 2015. I hope everyone had an excellent festive period and New Year. And yeah, we're excited to be back on the horse, I guess, as they say. Unfortunately, it's just me and my 100% pure pressed pineapple juice this week. But we will have more people on next week. So we've obviously taken about a month off due to there not being much going on in the motorcycling world. And yeah, so there's one or two things to catch up on. This show is probably going to be pretty short. It's mostly going to be the couple of news items, specifically some BSB news has come out. There's been a pretty steady trickle of that for those who are interested. And then we'll also be starting to get through kind of the backlog of emails we have. I'm going to say that a lot of that backlog is caused by Peter Newell's quite lengthy emails, so we'll hopefully have at least one of them on the show. But let's just jump straight into it with some BSB news. So Josh Waters and Christian Iden have both been confirmed at Holzell Suzuki in BSB for next year. Waters was obviously on the Suzuki last year, but with Tyco, and now Tyco have transitioned to BMW. And then Christian Iden was riding the Bimota in World Superbike. He was doing quite well, I thought. And yeah, hopefully that team will be pretty good. You know, as we say a lot, the Suzuki Superbike is a bit old, and it certainly seemed to struggle a fair bit last year. Waters had a fair few good results, especially towards the end of the season. So, you know, hopefully he can keep that form up. In more British-ish news, the Honda Rhodes team for the Isle of Man and Northwest and all that sort of thing have unsurprisingly announced John McGuinness and Connor Cummins. Both of them will also be racing for, I think it's Jackson Racing, in the Stock World Endurance Series, so that'll be interesting to see. And then McGuinness will be running a private team for, I think it's the 600 class at the Isle of Man. So again, that'll be interesting. McGuinness and Padgett's are no longer together due to a sponsor conflict, I believe was the reason given. So, yep. And in more Isle of Man news, and perhaps even bigger Isle of Man news, is that Michael Dunlop, who, as we reported earlier, was kicked out, I guess, more or less from BMW, as, you know, the Tyco deal came together. Michael Dunlop has kind of unsurprisingly found a ride for the Isle of Man, but the team that he's with is quite surprising. It would be Milwaukee Yamaha. Obviously, Martrain Yamaha are the air quotes factory road racing Yamaha team. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what sort of support he gets, because Dave and I were chatting about this over text. If Milwaukee are the factory team in BSB, then surely their stuff's going to be as good, if not better, than what Martrain are getting. So what's to stop, you know, Michael jumping on Brock Parks's BSB Yamaha, tweaking one or two things, and then going for gold. So yeah, that'll be interesting to watch. It'll also be interesting to see if Michael Dunlop can win on the Yamaha, because if he can, he'll have won on, I think, almost every major bike bar the Suzuki, but even that he might have won on at the Isle of Man for all I know. But he's definitely won on a Honda. I think he won when he was on Kawasaki. I don't know. I'll have to look it up. If anyone knows, please feel free to write into Motopod at motopodcast.com for any questions you may have for any of the hosts. That gets checked pretty regularly. Unfortunately, we got a bit slack with reading out emails towards the end of the year, but we're getting through them, so be sure that if you do send in an email, we do receive it and we do try to reply. So now, back to some MotoGP news. Kind of, I don't know, everyone else seemed a bit more surprised by this than I did, perhaps. But Casey Stoner has renewed his role with HRC in his testing capacity. So he'll be doing some laps for Honda this year. He'll apparently be having a pre-season test at Sepang towards the end of January. But as was pointed out on Twitter, there's a testing ban until February. So, yeah, not sure how that one works. Might have to look into the rules around the testing bans a bit more closely. Stoner's obviously not a current GP rider, but the testing ban was blanket. So, yeah, we'll have to see. Also, in a Sepang thread, the GP 15 will not be at Sepang, as Ducati have, yet again, unsurprisingly, had to delay the bike. So Ducati will be bringing a GP 14.3 to Sepang, since that GP 15 is delayed. The GP 14.3 will have some new parts, but it seems like Ducati are basically flying all that way for more or less an electronics test, which is quite expensive, but hopefully it'll be another step in the right direction, and we can see both Dovizioso and Iannone fighting for the front. I mean, both riders, especially Iannone, certainly had flashes of brilliance last year. It's just that, unfortunately, Iannone's flashes of brilliance seem to quite quickly end with flashes of metal elbow slider unintentionally sliding along the ground. So, yeah, we'll have to wait and see. So, yeah, continuing on, there's been a lot of pre-testing news, kind of. Michael Laverty, who will be racing for the aforementioned Tyco BMW in BSB, he'll still be in the MotoGP world, as he has taken up a testing contract with Aprilia. They say that he will have at least one wild card on the Aprilia machine. He and Max Biaggi are the official Aprilia test team, so they'll be swapping and trading off testing duties. I unfortunately don't think that Max Biaggi will get a wild card. I'd love to see it, but don't think he will. Also, in more news, Forward Racing, they're obviously same sort of deal as last year, in that Yamaha are supplying them with basically a dumbed-down satellite bike. But when that was confirmed, I think it was towards the end of last year, Forward had said that they also wanted to carry on developing their own frame outside of racing. And yeah, that didn't seem like a good idea. That seemed like very expensive and resource intensive. But luckily, Forward have now seen the error of their ways and are sacking their kind of own frame ambitions. So they'll just be focusing on running the Yamaha ones, obviously with Loris Baz and Stefan Bradl. It's still not known whether they'll switch to KYB suspension. As we've talked about before, that seems like a pretty risky move just due to the kind of lack of experience of KYB, especially in comparison to Ohlins and Showa. You know, Showa struggle enough as it is, and they've been in GP for a lot longer than KYB. So, yeah, that'll be interesting. But perhaps kind of the most surprising and out there bit of news that came out quite recently, actually, was that it looks like Dominic Agata will be testing a Kawasaki MotoGP prototype on Michelin tyres in, I believe it's Jerez. So apparently Kawasaki have a new MotoGP prototype. I'm not sure if it's the same sort of Kawasaki that Barbera and Meglio were on before they switched to the Ducati, but from what I could read and find out, it does seem like maybe Kawasaki have been having a bit of a tinker. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see if that ever does happen. Again, this test is planned pre lifted the testing ban, so Race Direction have said that no, you can't do this test, it's illegal, because obviously there's the testing ban. So yeah, that'll be one to watch, and yeah, see how that one goes, because I don't know, I think it'd be really interesting to see Kawasaki come back. They're obviously doing quite well in World Superbikes. Speaking of, it was also announced today that Kawasaki and Monster Energy have teamed up officially. which means that Jonathan Rea ends his long run with Red Bull as a personal sponsor. So this year's really a whole new fresh start for Jonathan Rea, you know, stepping away from Honda now, stepping away from Red Bull. Fresh sheet. Let's get to it. World Superbike tests are starting to go on. There's one or two private tests. Pata Honda were out. There was a bit of I guess you could just classify it as banter or whatever, but it seemed like it was maybe a bit of a poke as well, where Sylvain Gintoli took a photo of the number one plate on the front of his bike and, you know, tweeted at Tom Sykes, "How does it look?" And Tom said, "Yeah, it looks all right, but I would have put it in the middle of the fairing because it was clearly a bit off-center." So maybe we'll get some more Tom Sykes social media wonders this year. That certainly spiced up things last year. So yeah, we'll hopefully start to get some more things about testing as they roll around. We'll now look at some emails that we've gotten. I think we'll hold off on Book Club until next week. It was quite a large section to read, so not everyone may have caught up. So I think we can just put a pin in that one and come back to it. So now for some emails. We will start with the most recent email, which is from TZ John and is actually about the Book Club. TZ John is very active on Twitter. If you don't follow him, you should. He loves a pair of pink shorts almost as much as I do, I'm pretty sure. So anyway, into his email. "Hi gents, bit late, but happy new year to you all." I'm sure he's saying that to all you fans as well. "Greetings from Sheffield in the grim north of England. First, I'd like to thank you for the Book Club idea. Spot on for an off-season talking point." Thanks, John. Glad you're enjoying it. "I have to initially say I had a bit of an issue getting into the book. I thought it was skimming across the surface of our sport, but ploughed on. I'm glad I did, and when Harry and Dave discussed it over the holidays, they were completely correct in their observation on who the book is aimed at. Maybe it is not directly aimed at those of us who own several different books and have owned several different anoraks over the years, but it's still a damn good read. At the point I'm at in the book, I'm not yet convinced over the Hailwood content, having read everything I can lay my hands on about Mike Hailwood, but I'm sure it will fall into place as we enter the final quarter of the book. For me, the narrative timeline running through the book so far is its strength, where we can see careers rising at different points in times, yet colliding. Although I've watched GPs since I've been small, some of the interactions and who was coming up at the same time was fresh. I'm looking forward to completing the book to see how the author brings all the strands together. A good choice, guys." So, yep, and then he signs off, zoom, zoom, TZ John. So, glad that you're enjoying the book, John. And, yeah, as I said before, if anyone else has any questions or comments about Book Club, motopod@motopodcast.com, send them in, and we'll definitely get them out on this show next week. But yeah, no, just going back to John's point about the kind of skimming over things. Yeah, it is quite broad in a lot of things, as we've said, but there's also some crazy details in there. Like I think it was in this section that everyone was meant to read for homework, about how it was Bridgestone that, you know, kind of put the kibosh on Colin Edwards originally coming over to MotoGP because he was such a good test rider that they didn't want to lose him. Or was it Michelin? I don't know. I can't remember. But yeah, it's just really interesting, and just little things like that, you know, like lots of people seemed to doubt Colin Edwards a fair bit, and yeah, he wasn't quite as quick as he was, and you know, maybe that was down to him, maybe that was down to the team, whatever, but yeah, I think that book does, you know, highlight some things like that some riders are just really valuable as test riders, and everyone, plays their role. So now we have an email from, email regular Scott Baldwin. And his is on the Super Prestigio, obviously the end of year dirt track event in Barcelona, where we had Crash.net's Neil Morrison come on and chat to us about that. I'm pretty sure that there's now a pretty extensive video of the Super Prestigio up on YouTube and things like that. So if you want to, if you haven't seen it and you want to see it, then just go search that out on the YouTube. So his email goes: "Super Prestigio only works because of its current format. It is a special day of fun for the very best of this year's riders in a format which limits the possibility of injuries. Changing it would take special fun aspects away. Indoor short track racing is fast and furious. The races are always too short. The first turn is too important. It all happens too fast." Get over it. That's just the way it is with wintertime indoor short track racing. "Super Prestigio on a longer track would only increase crash speeds and thus injuries. three races on three continents would make it expensive, which would make it serious, which would not make it fun, which would kill it. Super Prestigio is a special day of fun. There's no money, and the short track randomness of it allows the guys to let their egos take the day off somewhat. So everybody can grin all day just about how great it is to be there playing with motorcycles. Wayne Rainey said it was never as much fun as when he and Eddie Lawson used to go to the parking lot of an abandoned racetrack and race around a couple of barrels all afternoon. Super Prestigio is sort of like that. First of all, thank you for the email, Scott. Second of all, Dave Neal and I had kind of questioned the format of Super Prestigio as is addressed. It is very short and a bit hectic, but I think Scott brings up some excellent points that it does have that kind of maybe not backyard feel, but a bit more down to earth, and it is maybe just a bit more fun, and that maybe, you know, stepping it up even more and trying to make it more professional would kind of spoil that fun. Like, I'm sure it'd still be a spectacle if they did do that suggested thing around before a GP round, and then the round at the end of the year. So, yeah, I to be honest, hadn't thought about it in that context. So, yeah, I don't know. I personally think that you probably could make the track a little longer. Obviously, venue and things like that restrict it, but I think that, yeah, maybe just a bit of a longer track would just be a tiny bit better. But, you know, that is personal opinion. Okay, so now we have an email from Barry LeSurf, which goes, "Hi guys, in relation to your bit on possible engine sizes for the intermediate class in MotoGP, I would like to offer my opinion. Harry mentioned that Moto2 would be better to drop to a 500 twin limit, and then you would have a kind of upscaling classes that we had with two strokes. I kind of like the idea, although I would drop all three classes in capacity. I would have a 150 single for Moto3, a 300 twin for Moto2, and a 600 four-cylinder for MotoGP. The reason is that I think the current engine sizes are too big and the bike's too fast, especially in MotoGP, where certain tracks are made to look like mini-bike tracks because of the powerful 1-litre motors easily eat up the straights and the racing becomes somewhat processional and boring as such. Smaller engines would mean more racecraft, more slipstreaming, and closer racing as in Moto2 and 3. Even the great Jerry Burgess was a fan of a 600cc MotoGP engine rule. It could also mean a natural reduction in the use of electronics as power outputs would be significantly less, meaning the bikes could be cheaper to run. Who knows, at the end of the day, I'm just a fan with an opinion, and if these rule changes happened, it would be massive for the sport, but going forward, it would give engineers a fresh challenge, and I'm convinced more manufacturers and private teams would get involved." So, yeah, the whole engine debate kind of continually rages almost no matter what Dorna and the FIM do. I'm sure that anything they do is never going to make anyone happy, but I think that you your point, Barry, about smaller engines leading to more racecraft and therefore in theory better racing is very true. Your point about Moto2 and especially Moto3 is hugely valid. The only thing, I mean, as you say, it's, well, not as you say, you know, it is unfortunately a bit of a pipe dream to think that we're going to get all three classes to change sizes once again. The cost, unfortunately, of that is so huge in terms of just the engineering cost that it's almost never going to happen unless everyone in the world suddenly becomes very, very rich. But yeah, your point then again about the tracks being, you know, looking small in comparison to these bikes is definitely true. And, I think that was kind of one of the issues with Bridgestone, was that the Bridgestones did allow huge corner speeds, which were massively, massively risky for all the riders. And I think it'll be really interesting to see what happens with Michelin, and if the lap times do drop, or if they go to being a bit slower as Michelin get back into the things and riders and teams adjust. I think that'll be big. Unless we do the suggestion of dropping all the sizes down, I think that we're never going to get it an electronics free or an electronics reduced environment, because as you say, it is just too powerful and too dangerous, I guess would be the word. And now we come to the big poppy, something like that. The big poppy of all emails. Peter Newell with one of his behemoth emails. So I'm quickly going to take a sip of my pineapple juice before we dive into this one, because it's a bit big. From memory, it does kind of touch on the same subjects. Throughout the year, we kind of continually brought up, the struggles that Moto2's having, especially now that we've seen that Suda are almost completely gone from the Moto2 class, and it's now, basically becoming like the series? World Superbike, what size Hondas do they race? I don't know. But yeah, it's basically becoming like that, where it's, everyone on the same bike, which maybe the racing will be good, but yeah, Moto2 was maybe not that exciting last year. But anyway, drink time. Peter's email starts, "Hi Dave, Harry, Jim, Martin, and Martin of Arabia. Regarding Honda engines and Kalex chassis/frame/whatever we want to call it this week, becoming the standard in Moto2, I'm of two minds about the current engine deal making Moto2 a spec formula. I think the Kalex Honda combination to some degree caps the costs of running a team when the team has essentially minimal development costs and allows more teams to compete, something which I think Dorna are obviously trying to encourage. To some degree, Mark VDS, Aspar/Paginas Amarius Pons HP40, and Intervetten are dominating the rest of the Moto2 field, not unlike the big three factories do in MotoGP, because of bigger budgets and better technical staff than their competitors." Okay, we're gonna pause the email and we're gonna discuss those first couple sentences. Yeah, I'd agree that certainly Mark VDS really did, especially this year, dominate the field, and I think that they'll continue to do that next year with Rabat and now with Alex Marquez, and that, despite all the bikes in theory being similar, bigger teams with bigger budgets are going to be able to get better mechanics, and when everything is equal like that, it's things like mechanics. Obviously, the rider makes a huge difference, but, mechanics and how quickly they can work and, how well data engineers work and things like that do make a difference. So, sure, you're going to have some upsets on occasion where a rider from, maybe not the biggest team will win a race, but it's definitely, always going to be those air quotes factory teams, your Mark VDS's, your Pons, that are up there fighting for the championship every weekend. Back to the email. So, it seems to me that this year Moto2 had a similar predictable formula for winners and places as MotoGP, in that Tito Rabat, brackets Marquez, had occasionally been knocked off the top of the finishing order by Callio, brackets Lorenzo, or by Luthi, brackets Rossi. Clearly there, he's making an analogy that those riders were the other riders, if you didn't get it. I think Tito Rabat is at his peak as a rider within the formula, and his and the team's massive work effort paid off in huge dividends. Considering all the laps Tito did this year, Mark VDS must have changed quite a few engines, more than the competition, I'll bet. If this made it seem a bland season for racing compared to the past year's finishes, then I think you can blame the blandness more on the lack of a bitter Espargaro-Marquez-Redding or Redding-Espargaro-Jewel than Honda's engine in the Kalex chassis/frame, brackets TM Harry Lloyd. I'd agree. I mean, in Moto2, engines get handed out, but I know that certainly the case was a few years ago was that if you felt that you had gotten a bit of a dud engine, you could pay money, I think it was something like €20,000, to get a different engine. I certainly remember Mark VDS doing that one time with Redding, when Redding was fighting for the Moto2 title. So, yeah, that just comes back to the point that, rich teams are always going to, or not always, but are most of the time going to be able to do well, and are most of the time going to have a slightly easier time of life than the teams that are really struggling for funding, your Gino Rea Racings, for example. And now back to the email. If Moto2's engine supplier opens up, I think the technical interest factor and development side of the formula will emulate MotoGP. The devil's in the details will be how to cap engine costs, air restrictors, !! close brackets. And will it lead to better racing? If one engine manufacturer gets upset at the others, a la Honda and Moto3, will this lead to full factory competition among engine builders with the resulting large cost passes onto the teams? There are plenty of uncontrollable variables in the mix if the engine development box is opened. I think Dorna is just kicking the ball down the field for now, as it has its hands full with plenty of other problems such as World Superbike, ECUs, and money. I would say my fear is that Moto 2 will, with open engine suppliers, might devolve into 14 bike grids if the costs increase to a great degree that the teams can't afford to participate. Is Moto 2 financially strong enough to support multiple engine manufacturers and still provide good close racing is the question. I'm not sure it is right now. Yeah, I definitely have to agree with you on that one, Peter. I think that if we were, if Dorna, not we, if Dorna were to open up Moto 2 to other engine manufacturers, even in a similar way that Honda does it, so, you know, you can either take a Honda engine, a Kawasaki engine, or a Yamaha engine at the start of the season, then costs would skyrocket, you know? Not only do you have to start developing Kalexes or whatever that now fit a Yamaha R6 engine, but then, you know, how does that engine characteristic, like, how does that affect how the bike handles, so therefore how do you have to change the frame more than just physically fitting the engine in there? So, yeah, I think that, I mean, I personally think that it'd be really good to open up Moto 2 to other engine suppliers. I think that if that were the case, then we could also get Moto 2 at more domestic series, because then you could get, you know, your bike importers, your large bike suppliers, a bit more on board. The issue now is that, you know, I think we've said this before, that, you know, a company like Tamworth Yamaha, I think they're quite a big dealer in the UK. Is Tamworth Yamaha and never going to be interested in investing anything in Moto 2 because it's all Honda, and so obviously if they're a Yamaha supplier, there's no point. So I think that unfortunately money is the real big issue. And then again, as you say, Dorna have other things such as World Superbike and ECUs. You know, I think that unfortunately, I think that Moto 2 kind of becomes the third tier of Dorna's worries. They obviously have MotoGP as their prime worry, then World Superbikes, and then you get down to your Moto 2 and your Moto 3 in terms of, you know, making them attractive and making them exciting. You know, a lot more people watch MotoGP than watch Moto 2 and things like that. So the concern for Dorna is obviously going to lie there and sorting out those things. But maybe once we do have a thriving GP grid, which, you know, it's, to be honest, things are looking up, it seems. You know, obviously we'll have to wait till 2016 in the Michelin tyres to see if it's still Marquez domination. But it does look like things are definitely getting better for MotoGP. You know, it's not like the early Norton... the late noughties, I guess that's what the late 2000s are called, you know, from 2009 to like 2011, you know, we sometimes had grids that had 13 starters on them, so as long as you finished, you got 2 points, because, you know, one or two riders were out injured. So I think that, yeah, we're definitely out of that danger zone, and now it's just a matter of Dorna sorting out MotoGP and World Superbike, and then maybe they do come and revisit Moto 2 and try and spice things up a bit there, because it has been a bit of a shame, because, you know, when Moto 2 first came in, it was absolutely insane, you know, 40 riders or whatever it was all piling into the first corner. You'd never really seen anything like that at that level, certainly. I think that also something that's happened with Moto 2 is that in the first year of Moto 2, it was a bunch of, like, crazy young kids. Like, you know, you had your Tony Elias's and your Alex de Bons, who had, you know, a fair bit of experience outside of things bigger than a 125. But then, like, the rest of the field were all these guys who had, you know, never ridden anything bigger than a 250, and it was this new class, so everyone was trying something crazy. But now, you know, everyone's gotten used to it. They know how you have to ride these bikes. The riding style's becoming even more refined, rather. You know, you don't see quite as much sliding in Moto 2 as you used to. So, yeah, I think it's just that thing of they do need something to spice up in Moto 2. Maybe not an engine change. I don't know. I don't know what you could do other than an engine change to spice up Moto 2. If you have any ideas on how to spice up Moto 2 other than an engine change, motopod@motopodcast.com with your suggestions. But, yeah, I think we just maybe do need to spice it up. Maybe, I don't know, maybe need to spend, I don't know, something. I don't know. And I certainly don't think that... like financial caps and restrictions on how much you can spend are the way to spice things up, because there's so many ways to just fudge things like that, and it's how do you check that sort of thing. So that is, I think that's our first little show of the year. That's half an hour. That's decent. Hope everyone enjoyed that, and please do send in some more emails. I think that next show, it'll be another quite email-heavy show, and we'll also look ahead to testing. Hopefully that should almost certainly be next week. I'll hopefully have someone back on with me. And if not, hopefully there'll be two people here. One of them doesn't have to be me. We have a litany of hosts who can do it. But yeah, looking forward to getting back into racing and to, you know, to go testing, you know. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens in testing. I think that this first Sepang test, especially for MotoGP, maybe won't be too exciting, especially with Ducati not fully there. But I think that the test after, when Ducati bring that GP15 out, I'm going to be pretty excited. And, you know, I don't usually get too excited about testing because, you know, it's grain of salt with the times and all that sort of thing. But, yeah, I think that it'll be pretty interesting to see. And, yep, so we'll catch everyone next week. And hope everyone's enjoying their new year. Bye.